Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a bonus episode of The Yield. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr. I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Brad Pilcher from Bonaccord Capital Partners, a subsidiary of P10 Holdings, a leading provider of private market and impact investing strategies with over $14 billion in AUM, for a conversation around private equity, GP stakes investing, and current market opportunities. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have this conversation today, but I figured maybe to start off, you could introduce yourself a little bit more formally, maybe walk everyone through your current role as well as a little bit of your background.
Sure. So I'm Brad Pilcher, partner and one of the founding members of Bonaccord Capital Partners. Started my career back in the early 2000s at Bridgewater Associates, and subsequently came together with two of my partners, AJ Chikara and Farhad Dehesh, in the mid-2000s at Swiss Re. We're at a focus on deploying about $5 billion and ultimately closer to 10 of balance sheet capital in an array of strategies, including, among other things, structured alternative investing. You know, in our time at Swiss Re is when we really first started looking at the opportunities to provide strategic growth capital to alternative investment managers, given all the same dynamics that we see today, increasing demand for capital, increasing demand to launch new products and diversify the business. Subsequently, the three of us worked together at Guggenheim Partners, where we had a focus really on strategic development within the alternatives business. So looking at this business very much from the opposite perspective of not how do we invest in alternative investment managers, but how do we help them to grow, which was really an illustrative experience in how we think about implementing our strategy here at Bonaccord, which of course we'll talk to you about. In 2017, we formed Bonaccord Capital Partners, with a focus on acquiring non-control equity interests in mid-sized private market sponsors. And you know, I'm a member of the team, just kind of looking to do whatever we have to do to keep the lights on.
That's very helpful insight. So maybe you could kind of walk the audience through a little bit more about, you know, what Bonaccord specializes in. And sure. Then also I would say, you know, recently I know that, you know, Bonaccord was once a part of Aberdeen and recently was acquired by P10. So maybe you could walk everyone through that transition as well.
Yep. So Bonaccord Capital Partners is a private equity business itself. And we invest in non-control equity investments in mid-sized private market sponsors. So a lot of explanatory words in there, but I would say as a general matter, what we do is buy pieces of private equity businesses. So rather than investing in the products themselves, we acquire an equity interest in the business that earns 2 in 20. Everybody knows from the outside looking in that private equity businesses are remarkably profitable businesses and certainly ones that have a very strong growth trajectory around them. And what we're looking to do is to give investors exposure to that substantial profitability and kind of turn the equation on whether you're paying fees or earning them yourself. So it's an exciting business model, we believe. We were formed initially in 2017 as a part of Aberdeen Standard Investments. Earlier this year, we transitioned to become a part of P10, which is a transition we've been very excited about. Aberdeen was a great firm and a great sponsor for the business. You know, P10 is a great sponsor to help to take this business forward. P10 itself is a business that has a focus specifically on investing in the middle market across the private markets business spectrum. It's a publicly listed vehicle, I believe a little bit more than $1.5 billion market cap, and owns a number of subsidiaries who engage in private markets investing in the middle market. all the way from private equity funded funds to venture capital funded funds to NAV-based lending platforms, private credit investments, ESG investments in the private market space, and with us in GP Minority Stake Investing.
So it's very helpful. I mean, you actually mentioned there, one, P10 kind of has, a large scale that hopefully, Bonaccord and your partners will be able to tap into. But I'm kind of curious, it sounds almost like a little bit of a multi-boutique model. You know, what are maybe some of the benefits or competitive advantages that you get both from having maybe potentially, I don't want to put words in your mouth, some independence, but also, the ability to rely on some other partners maybe who are targeting, similar companies or at least portions of the market?
Yeah, that's a great question. So P10's business model very much is to acquire great businesses, let them run and provide them with resources to help them grow. Honestly, not too dissimilar from the way that we look at doing our minority investment strategy. But of course, they own entire businesses. Some of the other businesses within the stable include RCP Advisors. RCP is, I believe, roughly a $9 billion lower middle market and middle market oriented private equity fund of funds business. So they invest in private equity funds with exactly the same types of sponsors that we look to buy into. In addition, they have a group, TrueBridge Capital, which I believe is a $4 to $5 billion venture capital oriented fund of funds business. Also trafficking in a similar size segment to where we typically like to play in certain of their investments. In addition to that, we have Enhanced Capital, which is an ESG-oriented platform, Five Points Capital, which is a lower middle market, direct lending and non-control equity platform, and Hark Capital, which is in fact also part of Aberdeen Standard Investments along with us, which focuses on lending into private equity companies to help them, private equity funds to help them grow their portfolio companies. So there are a lot of synergies in a number of ways. When we look at our business, although we're not a fund of funds business, we're not investing in private equity funds, there are very natural synergies to being associated with fund of funds businesses. And that's for a few reasons. Number one is it's an excellent platform for origination of new investment opportunities. If we look at RCP, for example, they have invested with many hundreds of lower middle market private equity sponsors over their life. In fact, they've invested with most of our private equity portfolio companies. It's one of the reasons we came to know the group because, let's say, we're fellow travelers in a very similar market segment. But not only do they help us to bring in opportunities, which is a critical part of any private equity business, but also help us to evaluate them. Certainly by partnering with the teams there, we can quickly get up to speed, ask probing questions, understand the way that they analyze the underlying investment strategy, which is, of course, the core to the success of any private equity firm from a business perspective. So that's very accretive to our investment process as well. The third piece is when we think about strategic development with our portfolio companies, helping them to grow, helping them to launch new products, helping them think through how to bring something to market. Just sitting alongside these businesses that have invested in many hundreds of private equity funds, if not thousands, in addition to all the other activities they carry out in the space, whether that be from a lending perspective or from an ESG perspective. As we seek to help our portfolio companies grow and institutionalize, which is a critical value-added component of our strategy, having access to those other resources internally is a huge strategic benefit.
That's fantastic. And you mentioned a couple times again this private equity concept. And certainly we've had some conversations around private equity and venture capital, in previous podcasts and the like. But maybe you can take a quick second, kind of define a little bit of private equity as how Bonaccord defines it. And then maybe we could also just contrast that a little bit to venture capital. And, I know as markets evolved and companies stay private longer, there's a little bit of overlap now and the companies that they both may play in. Certainly what Bonaccord focuses on is a little bit unique there. So maybe you could kind of triangulate all those different components.
Sure. So, private equity as a general matter is the business of buying into companies that are not available for sale in the public market. And there are different ways that can be done. The different types of companies that can be bought into. So if we try to kind of bifurcate private equity in general, we have a mix of non-control investing, which is where we play, investing in companies where you don't, in fact, own and control them, but certainly can act as a strategic partner to help them grow. And then control stake equity investing, where you see private equity firms who buy an entire company and control that business, hire and fire management, and drive the business forward. Within the non-control element of it, there are a number of different business models in terms of stage and maturity of investment. And certainly you see the typical words that people will talk about are venture capital or growth capital. Obviously, it's a continuum. There's not necessarily a fixed bright line between any one of these strategies. But as a general matter, when you think of venture capital, you think of early stage non-control investments. investing in and providing capital to great high growth early stage businesses. It's an investment strategy that in recent years has had remarkable returns, but one that has very different risk return characteristics. If you're a venture capital investor, you know, you may have any number of the investments in your portfolio that have a very low return, and you have some that might return to you 10 or 20 or 30 times your money or more, depending upon where they invest. So very attractive investment strategy when investing in early stage businesses. And given that where most of the high growth businesses are today in the early stage has very much typically a technology orientation. There are also non-control investments in more mature businesses, typically referred to as growth capital. Again, to your point, Peter, given the period of time for which technology companies or early stage companies are staying private, certainly we've seen a huge proliferation of those growth stage investments where it's no longer investing in a startup, but it is making a non-control investment in a high growth business. And what we do has a lot of analogies to what you see in the growth capital world, which is we're focused on investments in companies who have achieved substantial growth, have substantial growth ahead of them, but are now mature, stabilized businesses looking to take on additional capital and partners to help them take the next step. So if you're to analogize what we do to any kind of more commonly discussed investment strategy, we really are growth capital for private markets managers within the financial services space. You know, the only other differentiation I'd make is, you know, when you look at venture capital versus what I'll call buyout investing, leverage buyout investing, where people are acquiring control stakes in businesses, you know, as you know well, again, you know, in the venture space, there is much more of a technology orientation. When we look at buyout investments, it's really a much more diversified mix of businesses. It's not necessarily just buying a high technology company. You could buy a company that makes tires or makes telephone poles. You know, it could be anywhere from very high technology to very boring and sleepy, but it's an investment strategy that if it's done well, can generate very high returns.
And I think how you described it too, right, is that, you know, all companies at different stages in their lives need likely to have some capital available to continue to grow and expand and take on new endeavors. Sometimes that's outside capital, and sometimes obviously you can kind of fund from your own business operations. And I think how you described it, really, you're providing that growth capital to alternative asset managers, which is also known as, you know, again, taking a GP stake, which is, again, maybe a little bit more of a technical term, but one that I think is important and, again, very analogous to the example you provided. Before we talk a little bit more about GP stakes investing specifically, perhaps you could just let everyone know and understand who the GP is and maybe also what an LP is and how that relationship is. And then maybe I'll help provide a little context for as we continue using the term GP going forward.
Sure. So, yeah, let's do some defined terms because there are a lot of different words that people use to describe our investment strategy. So Peter, you're right. The term of art that people typically use to refer to this business is GP stakes. The reason that people use the word GP stake, to your point, is about the GP-LP relationship. Most private equity vehicles are formed as limited partnerships, in which the limited partners are the investors who provide capital, and the general partner, or the GP, is the entity that, in fact, controls that partnership. Sometimes people refer to that group as the manager. Typically, when I speak about this strategy, I'll refer to them as the sponsor. But really what we're talking about is the business that manages the funds. And those funds that we look at range anywhere from private equity to private credit to real estate and real assets. So although we're discussing private equity, what we're looking at is private markets broadly, the world of acquiring private assets, which could be corporate assets in the case of equity. They could be loans to corporations or backed by, you know, real assets in the case of credit. Or in the case of real estate and real assets, it could be buying buildings or buying wind farms or buying any other kind of real asset or property.
And just to elaborate on that, and please correct me or enhance my response, but, you know, the key there is, you know, a fund-to-fund business would be the example of a fund purchasing a stake as a, you know, an LP or equivalent in the actual fund. What you guys do is, again, buy an ownership of the management company itself.
Yeah. Very simply, as the LP, you pay fees. As the GP, you earn fees. And so in the case of our investments, we want to be sitting in the same seat as the sponsor or the general partner who's earning the fees.
So maybe to that point, we can first start, you know, why is GP stakes then, you know, to that point around fees, why is it such an attractive business, especially for, you know, a private equity strategy?
Sure. So I would divide it into two pieces, you know, and I think through the answer to that question. The first is, why is the private markets sponsorship business model so attractive? And the second question is, why is investing in those businesses so attractive? So, you know, there are three characteristics that we really think make private market sponsors remarkably attractive businesses. It's stability, profitability, and growth. So from a stability perspective, you know, certainly you talked about many investments that you guys have looked at in the venture capital space. And of course, one of the critical buzzwords that helps to drive phenomenal valuations in technology is recurring revenue. You know, looking at businesses that have contractual, stable, locked in revenue streams is something that the markets put phenomenal value on. And many of those attractive recurring revenue business models are technology models. However, within financial services world, we believe that private market sponsors have a very similar and equally attractive recurring revenue business model. When a private market sponsor launches a fund, the capital they take in from investors is locked up for as long as a decade or longer. Very different from, for example, a mutual fund where you can subscribe one day and redeem the next, or a hedge fund where you can subscribe one day and redeem the next month. If you invest in a private equity vehicle, you are entrusting the private equity sponsor with your capital for a very long period, over which they can prudently make investments over a period of years, grow those companies over a period of years, and ultimately sell them and return the capital over the course of a decade. As a result of what I call a closed-end nature of those private equity funds, where capital can't be redeemed, you know that there is revenue that's going to come from those funds come rain or shine. If the value of the underlying investments goes up, the fees come in. If the value of the underlying investments goes down, the fees come in. And if there's a period of market strain when companies or properties can't be sold, that business continues to earn fees. And so it's a remarkably stable business. In addition to that, when you think of buying into a private market sponsor, you're not investing in the fees or the profits coming from managing a single fund. A private market sponsor typically has many active funds at the time that you invest. You know, you may invest in a sponsor has four funds of different vintages, even if they have a single product line. And in many cases, they'll have multiple product lines. So the end result of that is just remarkable durability and revenue visibility. But it's not just stable revenues. Importantly, these are businesses that are already highly profitable. So this isn't investing in a recurring revenue business that will someday transition to profitability. These are businesses in many cases can run anywhere from a 40 to 70% operating margin, and importantly, generate a tremendous amount of cash. Many businesses, even that are highly profitable, if they require substantial capital expenditures to grow, can generate substantial profits without actually generating a lot of cash that can be distributed to investors. In the case of the private markets business model, they have very limited capital expenditure requirements. And so when they generate profits, that means there's cash that can be distributed to their partners. In addition to profitability, the final piece is growth. I think everybody knows over the course of the last 30 years, private markets have grown phenomenally. If you looked at the size of a private equity fund in 1989 and you looked at it today, the size of those funds would be very different, and certainly the size of the aggregate market is quite different. And the growth isn't done in our estimation. If you look at the secular long-term drivers of growth in private markets, they are all still there. There are massive segments of investors that are just beginning to come into private markets. Certainly the wealth space is one of the highest priority growth segments for many private markets managers. Within the institutional space, there are many institutional allocators who are consistently below their target allocation to private markets because of the success of the businesses and the pace at which they've sold companies or properties and returned capital to investors. In addition to that fact, many of those same investors are looking to increase their target allocations. And so we take those three pieces together, the stability that we have through the recurring revenue business model, the profitability through elevated fees, elevated profit margins, and the ability to make cash distributions, and historic and forecast growth, we think the business model is very strong. So before getting to the second piece, I just want to give you an opportunity to respond.
Yeah, I guess the thing that comes to mind for me, which is so funny, is that those all sound like great reasons to never give up any equity portion of your business at all. So maybe you can elaborate why some of these management companies and their partners and owners do decide to take in outside capital as opposed to, you know, and we use the example, you know, you look at the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, and so many of them are from and have historically been large equity holders of their private alternative asset management companies, the Steven Schwarzmans of the world, certainly the KKRs. You know, why give up any equity interest in your company knowing that there's such great characteristics of the businesses?
Sure. So, you know, there are financial and strategic reasons to take on a GP minority stake. And your question is typically the first question in many of these conversations. People understand how attractive the business model is and why would you ever give a piece of that up? And certainly why would you ever give a piece of that up at a fair price that allows somebody else to make a profit? The answer is twofold. It's financial and it's strategic. From a financial perspective, there are different reasons a sponsor might look to sell a piece of their business. And that can range from, you know, a desire to source capital to invest in their own products. You know, one of the dynamics you see, and again, just to go back to the venture world that you were referencing to, there are challenges of being a high growth business. They're great challenges to have, but they're very real. And what we've seen over time is many of these private market sponsors will have their fund size grow substantially as they launch new funds. You might raise $500 million in your current fund, $1 billion in your next fund, $2 billion in the fund after that. And concurrent with that, you know, you're making substantial investments into those vehicles. You know, private market sponsor typically makes what's called a GP commitment. They'll commit to invest a certain number of dollars or a certain percentage of every fund. And in many cases, in percentage terms, those GP commitments have gone up. So if you invested 1% of your $500 million fund, then you're investing 2% of your $1 billion fund, and then 3% of your $2 billion fund, sure, you're making a lot of profits, but that requires a lot of money to support the growth in that fund size. So that capital is important. It also can be important in the case of sponsors who are looking to diversify their business through launching new products. In many cases, if you're looking to seed a new product line, you might not say, I'm putting in 2%. You might want to just say, I'm putting in 50 million or I'm putting in 100 million, and I will start this new product as a show of confidence, which ultimately will lead to a lot of value creation within the business. So sourcing investment capital is one of the potential financial rationales. A second one is succession planning. We're investing in mature, stable businesses. And in many cases, there is an element of one generation of management beginning to think forward to 10 years in the future when they want to pass the baton to the next generation of management. In order to do that, they, in many cases, want to bring new partners into the business, find opportunities to be able to allow them to buy and become equity holders themselves. And a GP minority stake can be a critical piece of that to help them in that succession process. And so those are the two most critical financial rationales, but the one that's equally important is strategic. You know, I think everybody knows it's good to have friends, no matter what business you're in. And one of the things we see with private market sponsors, especially in the mid-size space that we focus on, is businesses that have achieved tremendous growth, have had great success in their core strategy offering, and are looking to diversify, have had great success raising capital in their home geography and are looking to internationalize, have had great success raising capital in certain client segments and are looking to diversify those. And in many cases, taking on a GP minority stake is part of the process to take the next step in growing, diversifying, and institutionalizing your business. And from that perspective, you need a partner who can help with that, one who can provide you with insight on how to grow and develop and institutionalize your business, help you in the strategy around how to construct, architect, and launch new products, help to plug you into critical investor bases, investor channels, help you to tackle new geographies. And we really, in our segment, have aimed to be the strategic partner of choice who can help mid-sized sponsors to take the next step in institutionalizing their business. Where that strategic component, that strategic rationale exists, that's where you can actually buy into a business in a way that allows you to profit alongside partners. Because ultimately, a sponsor is looking for strategic support. Certainly, these are smart people. They're in the business of buying and selling properties or companies. They understand how to value their business. So they're not going to sell 20%, for example, of their company for an unfair price to them, but they're going to be taking into account both the value at which they're selling 20%, but as well as the impact of the partnership on the 80% of the business that they retain. And if you demonstrate to them that the value that you can do, that you can drive, and the 80% of their business that they retain is substantial, then you have an opportunity to come into the business on fair terms and for everybody to profit together.
That's tremendously helpful. You know, you had mentioned a couple of times that you focus, you know, on mid-sized asset management companies. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about, you know, why Bonaccord, you know, typically chooses to play in that part of the market as opposed to maybe, you know, some larger or even smaller companies.
Sure.
And then maybe just a little bit around, you know, what type of businesses you do look at in terms of any criteria that you guys, you know, really consider.
Mm-hmm. So I'll start with the size piece. Our business model, I guess the first thing I'll say is there are many attractive ways to invest in this space. We have chosen a particular one that we think is the most attractive and best suited to us. There are different investment strategies that have different risk return characteristics. So if you were to look at, for example, investing in earlier stage or smaller companies, In this world, you typically see that in what's referred to as seed investing, finding an early stage or startup manager, providing them with investment capital, and retaining a piece of their revenues or their profits on a go-forward basis. That can be an attractive investment strategy, but when we talk about stability, profitability, and growth, you know, from a stability perspective, a startup manager with one fund, from our perspective, doesn't demonstrate the institutional stability and certainly doesn't demonstrate the same profitability that you see from a mature manager with many funds in the ground. Now, from a growth perspective, those investments could perform remarkably well. And so it's an interesting strategy, can be an attractive strategy. It's just different from ours. And the investors who invest with us are looking for something different with more of a stable, lower risk investment strategy that still can provide what we believe should be very high returns. We invest in the midsize, and I'll talk about why we do that. But to contrast the other one, which is very large manager investments, you know, there are plenty of very capable private market sponsors who do large scale GP stake investing. And that can be an attractive investment strategy for certain investors. But the reasons that we prefer our space, and I'll explain why. The first one is the inherent fundamental characteristics of the businesses themselves. When we talk about stability, profitability, and growth, you know, investing in mid-sized sponsors, from a stability perspective, we think we've sacrificed very little, if anything, in comparison from investing in a $30 billion manager, where we invest in, say, a $3 billion manager. And that's because in many cases, the stability is inherent in the business model. A private market sponsor raises capital and it's locked up for up to a decade or longer. It's hard to make that unstable, especially in a sponsor who has a long track record. You know, if you look at our target investments, we're looking at companies who have been in business for a decade or longer, have a strong track record of performance and growth, have a stable, diversified partnership team. So from a stability perspective, we believe we sacrifice almost nothing. From a profitability perspective, we think that the sponsors in our segment are as profitable or as a percentage of assets under management, in many cases, more profitable than much larger sponsors. It's because in the mid-size space, fee rates are much more durable because they have a simpler operating model. In many cases, operating margins can be higher. And they have the ability, of course, to generate substantial cash. It's growth, though, which we think is really differentiating. When we look at growth, there are two pieces to it. The first one is growth in their core strategy. If you look at a mid-size sponsor who manages a $1 billion private equity fund, and if you look at a large sponsor who manages a $15 billion private equity fund, to grow from $1 billion to $2 billion is very achievable and has happened many, many times in history. To grow from a $15 billion fund to a $30 billion fund, I'm sure some sponsors will ultimately do that, but that will take a lot of time. It's absorbing a lot of the available capital that's out there in the market, and it will be much more challenging. So if you look at the potential for percentage-based growth in the core strategy, not dollar-based growth, but percentage-based growth, which is what impacts our investment return, it's much more attractive in the mid-size space. So by focusing on mid-size managers with very scalable strategies, we think their core product offering can grow much more. But it's not just that, it's also the ability to diversify the product offering. If you look at a $30 billion private market sponsor, they have likely raised capital in many strategies. They have likely raised capital around the globe. They've likely raised capital in every investor segment. You don't get to $30 billion without doing that. In our mid-size space, as I described, in many cases, they have a very successful core strategy offering and are looking to diversify into ancillary strategies. So in addition to a greater growth rate in their core offering, we think that the ability to add ancillary strategies can even further accelerate the growth rate in comparison to the very large manager investments. So that's the corporate characteristics. And before moving on to kind of market dynamics, I just wanted to give you the chance to ask any questions on that piece.
No questions on that piece. I was hoping to move to market dynamics. And also maybe you could parallel that a little bit with, you know, maybe what some of the risks are as well to the strategy, especially as it relates to the market backdrop.
Sure. So the second reason we find the mid-size space to be very attractive is the comparative competitive dynamics. You know, if you look at it from a risk, from a supply and demand perspective, our larger peers have had remarkable success to their credit in raising capital for very large funds to pursue large manager GP stakes investments. And if we were to look at the three large players today focusing on principally large GP investments, you know, they between their three active funds, I think should have close to $20 billion of capital to invest in large manager investments. In the space that we're focused on, we would estimate there probably will be somewhere in the range of $3 to $4 billion pursuing mid-sized manager investments. Just an estimate, but should be roughly accurate. And so, you know, you take those together and there's probably roughly a fifth of the capital, maybe a quarter of the capital pursuing the mid-size opportunity in comparison to the large manager opportunity. Now, how comparatively large are the opportunity sets? You can look at it in terms of number of firms, or you can look at it in terms of total capital in these segments. In terms of number of firms, we estimate that the large manager space has somewhere in the realm of 60 addressable firms. These are sponsors with $10 billion or more who aren't publicly listed, who have not historically sold a stake to another player. So in terms of originating de novo GP stakes opportunities, there are 60 really high conviction targets that could be focused upon. In our mid-size space of 1 to 10 billion, we estimate that's about 800. Now, of course, the sponsors in our segment are smaller than in the large segment by definition. And so the next question is how much capital is in that space, which is a proxy for how much capital we could invest in those target segments. In the large manager space, we estimate there's somewhere in the realm of $1.2 trillion. In our segment, we estimate there's about 2.1. So you take all of that together, and we estimate that in our space, there's, you know, at most a quarter of the dry powder pursuing 13 times the number of managers and 175% of the addressable opportunity. So very favorable comparative competitive dynamics. That impacts valuation. You know, more capital pursuing a smaller opportunity naturally implies competition on valuation and more limited ability to be selective than we have in our segment. So there are investments in tremendously high caliber sponsors. You know, if I were to look at the large manager GP stakes investments, almost every single one of them is an investment in a great business. But it's one of them where the competitive dynamics and the valuation pressure associated with it are very different. And we believe the potential for growth is different. And the last piece, just to reiterate the prior point on why sell a stake, is, you know, if you look at the large manager space, I believe there's much less strategic value to a sponsor than there is in the midsize. For the very simple reason that, you know, as we discussed, if you've gotten to $30 billion, you've probably figured out most of the different ways to raise capital in different geographies, different channels. You've probably figured out how to launch most of the new strategies that you want to launch. And so a GP stake transaction is really a monetization of a mature business. Where on the one hand, you could do an IPO, which comes with regulatory scrutiny, cost, and complexity. Or on the other hand, you could take in a GP stake investment from one of the large players. And so for a GP at the scale of $30 billion, that can in many cases be a much more attractive decision than going public. However, because there's not much strategic value, you're really going to be focused much more on what's the financial value of the transaction in terms of check size and valuation, and probably less on strategic value. In our segment, we view it much more as growth capital, where the strategic value is first and foremost the consideration in choosing a partner. And we've experienced that over and over. And so the valuation pressure, even before taking into account those very different competitive dynamics, is very different.
No, that's great. You know, I just have, I think, one last question for you. And I know it's one that, you know, we see a lot of headlines on, and maybe you can add a little context to. But, you know, oftentimes people see some private market fees as being high, right? And I know there's context that needs to come with that too, but certainly I'd imagine that's a risk of the businesses, as you mentioned, healthy cash flows and recurring revenue. Maybe you can contextualize kind of the fee model that you guys, you know, look into and whether or not you think that's sustainable and kind of how it relates to the strategy or, you know, what Bonaccord does overall.
Yeah. So I think if you look across asset management, the stability of fees is very much a function of comparative supply and demand dynamics. LP interest in the strategy versus available funds to invest in. And obviously that's typically correlated with growth. If you have an excess of demand for an investment product, ultimately those investment products will grow in size. And so in a growth environment, we see a lot of fee stability. We've seen other strategies where there's been fee compression, whether that be in the hedge fund world where fees compressed substantially over time when the supply demand dynamics became less favorable. Similarly, in traditional asset management where many investment products were under threat from passives or ETFs, and as a consequence, had to reduce their fee rate substantially. In the private market space, we see very different dynamics. Private equity fees across the spectrum are very stable. They're typically higher in the mid-size space than the very large-size space. If you're raising a $2 billion private equity fund, you can raise that at a 2% fee. If you're raising a $15 billion private equity fund, in many cases, you have to accept substantially larger fees. Now, the aggregate revenues you generate from that are substantially higher. But if you look at a percentage of assets...
Right. You're saying if you're doing a $50 million fund, you'd charge higher fees or potentially lower fees?
Lower fees. Very large funds typically have lower fee rates. They have higher revenues because they're much bigger. But I would say in the large space and in the mid-size space, fees are stable. They're just higher typically in the mid-size space. So as long as these growth dynamics persist, we anticipate that fees will remain relatively stable. Of course, when we invest in a manager, if we think there's a potential for their fee rate to decline, we'll bake that into our underwriting and we'll underwrite accordingly. But that's not typically the case in the strategies that we're reviewing. you know, the one place where you have seen institutional investors maintaining low overall fee rates is not in the fees that they pay for investing in the fund. It's through the addition of co-investment. So if you're a large pension plan or insurance company deploying $500 million with a sponsor, in many cases, your fee reduction comes much less from reducing the fee that you get from investing in the fund. Your fee reduction comes from getting the opportunity to invest directly in deals alongside the fund with no fees and no carried interest attached. So where we've seen large investors getting a deal, so to speak, in private markets is typically through getting a larger allocation to co-investments and typically much less in terms of reducing overall fee rates.
Okay, that is great. And you know, one of the things that I know we talked about in you know, our conversations before this is also, you know, again, if there wasn't a market for such fees, you know, certainly they wouldn't be paid, but clearly those investors have found value in, you know, investing in some of these strategies. And thus, obviously, the managers themselves can extract out some fees, particularly around performance.
Yeah. And it's a funny dynamic, Peter, because one of the things as an investor in private markets funds, that there are two things they typically don't like or complain about, let's say, which is if the fees are too high or if the sponsor grows too much. You know, many institutional investors say, I'd like you to charge low fees and I'd like your fund size never to increase. You know, the joke we always have with those investors is, listen, the fees are going to be what they are. The sponsors are going to grow the way that they grow because everyone's investing more money. Rather than being upset about it, wouldn't you like to share a piece of the profits when that happens? So maybe you'll be sad when a sponsor of the $1 billion fund comes out with a $2 billion fund. But if you own a piece of that business and your fee profits double as a result of that, you're going to find a way to be much more comfortable with that dynamic.
No, very fair. So I want to pause here for a second. We've actually got quite a few questions that have come in related to Bonaccord and sort of what you do. Just for the sake of time, I'll ask maybe for some brief responses.
Sure.
And certainly just want to try to get to everyone's questions.
We'll do a speed round.
All right. First one that came in was, how is Bonaccord differentiated from other competitors in the space, specifically Blue Owl?
Sure. So Blue Owl is the parent company now of Dyal Capital, who is by a substantial margin the largest player in GP minority stake investing. You know, they're a firm who has had great success raising tremendous amounts of capital. They've invested in some very high caliber sponsors. They are focused more than anybody, and I think they would advertise this themselves, on investing in the biggest sponsors. That is their competitive edge. They can find access to the largest opportunities and raise large enough pools of capital to deploy in those. You know, we're differentiated from them by our mid-size focus. We're focused on a different market segment. We happen to believe that that market segment is inherently more attractive and that we can achieve greater valuations, greater growth after the investment, and ultimately superior returns by investing in the mid-size space. Undeniably, investing in, you know, very large-scale investments has an inherent stability component to it. I think it's hard to see one of our businesses go away. It's certainly also hard to see one of the very large businesses go away. But I think you see a similar dynamic to what you see in many markets, which is you have large cap investments, you have mid cap investments. In large cap investments, you sacrifice some degree of growth opportunity or return potential for the stability of investing in very large companies. In our segment, we think that we get much more return and growth potential. You know, while I'm sure if you were sitting in the seat of one of the large sponsor players, you'd say that we have less stability. Obviously, we'd argue against that. But certainly, we believe that the risk return, even here to accept the concept that there is less stability, given the incremental return potential in this mid-sized space, we think is much more attractive.
And you sort of touched on this, but I just want to make sure you have a chance to address it formally. But you know, the exit strategy, right? Certainly, how do you kind of monetize and get out of any of your investments?
Sure. You know, it's a typical, my personal opinion, a typical misperception that investing in GP minority stakes is fundamentally illiquid in a way that other private market strategies are not. What we've seen is that there are many precedents for generating liquidity from these types of investments, whether it be through selling a single stake or ultimately through monetizing an entire portfolio. So in our investment strategy, we construct portfolios of GP minority stake investments, and our principal intention is to monetize those in aggregate across the entire portfolio rather than by selling one stake or another. One of the benefits that we have of not being the first player in this space, where there are kind of three of the larger oriented players who came before us, is we've seen the way that these products evolve over time. And what we see is that the funds focused on GP minority stake investments that have been around for more than half a decade have tremendously consistently found opportunities to generate liquidity for their investors. In certain cases, that's been through selling the entire portfolio to a strategic buyer. There's a recent precedent with one of our competitors who did a public listing of a private fund to get liquidity in the public markets and gain access to the attractive valuations that we see in the public markets. And certainly there have been many circumstances where sponsors have taken on financing to do a dividend recapitalization and make early return of capital to their investors. So we think that the liquidity characteristics of the strategy, aside from just the yield that it can deliver through the profits and cash generation of the underlying portfolio companies, in addition to that, the ability to provide liquidity and ultimately monetize or exit these investments, we think will be very attractive.
That's fantastic. And actually just reading through the rest of the comments or questions, I actually think you address a lot of them, particularly around some of the risks. Also, again, you know, why GPs are sort of looking to even sell any of their stakes. So with that, Brad, I want to thank you again for taking the time. This was incredibly insightful, and I'm very confident that our audience enjoyed hearing all of your insights and learning quite a bit more about Bonaccord. Brad, we will say goodbye to you at this point, and I do want to encourage everyone to stay on for an opportunity for a very special announcement.
Thanks so much, Peter, and appreciate everybody taking the time to listen, and hopefully it was... Hopefully I didn't talk for too long.
Oh, it was, again, you're the star of the show. We're here just to make sure that our audience is able to hear from subject matter experts like yourself.
Take care.
So again, wonderful conversation with Brad. I think, you know, some of you at this point likely are somewhat regulars on YieldTree and know that we do try to feature, you know, strategy managers within some of our offerings that are, you know, again, really high caliber and ones that we hope are able to deliver, you know, significant returns to our investor community. And with that, for those of you who haven't checked your email and have not been on the site, we launched our Bonaccord Private Equity Fund, where we will place, similar to other third-party funds, we'll place the commitments of our fund into the Bonaccord GP Stakes Fund. So all the messaging that we just heard around, you know, the businesses and the strategy very much can relate to, you know, what this fund is designed to try to do. And with that, you know, I'll give you all a couple of statistics or at least targets for the fund, and then happy to open up for Q&A specific to the offering. So the fund's going to target an annualized return of 16 to 18% over the life of the fund. The underlying strategy, which is the private equity strategy that will focus on mid-size alternative asset management companies, is expected to return 20 to 25%. The target term for the fund will be 7 years. And we actually, for this fund strategy, a little bit different to other ones we've offered in the past, as of 9/40, Bonaccord has actually already called and deployed over 40% of capital. And it actually has investment positions already in 5 alternative asset management companies. If you do go onto the offering page for those management companies that they've purchased minority non-controlling stakes in, are actually publicly announced. So you can actually head over and see some of the current holdings there as another way to get more insights into the potential investment. You know, obviously we're very excited about, you know, working with and partnering with Bonaccord in this sense, but I do want to turn it over to everyone for Q&A and happy to address anything as it relates to the YieldTree Fund. The investment minimum on the fund will be $25,000. Like always, you know, relative to other investing directly into a Bonaccord fund or any of these other third-party funds, typically require check sizes in the hundreds of thousands to millions. Plus, this fund that we're actually investing in is currently closed and not accepting any additional investments. So this will be likely, to our knowledge, the only way to access this fund at this stage in time. Also on the site, we do have some other content around GP stakes investing to help everyone get more familiar and comfortable with the strategy overall. I mentioned a couple of investments already made to date. The strategy will intend to invest in about 8 to 10 private market alternative asset managers. So again, a diversified pool of asset managers, likely with, you know, to create a portfolio of diversified asset managers based on type as well, ranging from real estate, private equity, infrastructure, as well as private credit. So again, the target returns for the fund are 16 to 18%. For those that aren't aware, the YieldTree fees are going to be, laid out on the offering page. But generally speaking, YieldTree earns a 1% management fee. And in the event that the returns of the fund exceed the target range, the share of excess profits will go 95% to investors, with a balance of 5% being shared by YieldTree. So again, that upside participation is very much skewed towards the investors, but YieldTree does earn some incentive fee in the event that performance exceeds the target return range. So one of the questions is around taxes. You know, it should be known that this investment offering will generate a K-1. So for those not familiar, a K-1 is a little bit different than a 1099 and is typically issued in March or April. But that will be, again, you know, the tax structure for the fund. So the last day to invest is undefined. Yield Street has secured a commitment for a allocation of the strategy. So, you know, we will keep it open until that sells out. For those of you who are more frequent visitors to Yield Street, you've certainly seen, you know, certain deals sell at different paces than others. We're obviously very excited about this deal. So we do encourage everyone to take a close look. Certainly reach out to investments@yieldstreet.com if you do have any questions, and we can help answer any questions directly as opposed to on the webinar here. But certainly we do encourage everyone to take a look before it does eventually sell out. So will there be a full liquidation at the 5 or 7 years, or will roll into future investments with the original principal return? So again, the target term for the fund is going to be 7 years. Certainly there is the chance that portions of the investment do remain outstanding for longer. 7 years is when we believe essentially, you know, the return of capital or your initial investment, your risk capital is returned. These are estimates. As you can imagine, the market backdrop will dictate certain things around timing. Certainly, you know, and I want to speak for Bonaccord, but we can imagine that they don't want to necessarily sell a valuable asset into a poor market backdrop. So certainly there's some flexibility around there for them to maintain that asset in order to maximize, hopefully, the value that they're able to extract out of that asset. So one of the questions around Bonaccord's historical track record, to the points around, you know, Bonaccord starting off in 2017, as well as we heard, the depth of experience of the team. Overall, at Bonaccord, the team members have done over $750 million of commitments in this space, but the fund's track record, we're actually not able to share at this point. So that appears to be all the questions. I want to thank everyone again for taking the time to join us today. Certainly, please do head over to yieldstreet.com and take a look at the offering. And obviously, you know, keep an eye out as we have more offerings coming over the balance of the year, and obviously, hopefully into next year as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.